Welcome to the seventh debate hosted by the Soho Forum. I'm Gene Epstein, economics and book review editor of Barron's Financial Weekly and the director of the Soho Forum. The Soho Forum has a twofold mission. First, to present sizzling debates between brilliant people on issues that interest freedom-loving folks. And second, and just as important, the Soho Forum is meant to be a place where people can socialize, get to know each other. That's the purpose of the wine and cheese reception, which has already started and will last until 9. I'm sure you'll have plenty of time then to get home before the blizzard starts. For me, the Soho Forum is a labor of love, in part because it's run by a group of loving volunteers, including my wife, Hisako Kobayashi, who provides all the food, and by my friends, John Kunze, and my co-founder, Naomi Brockwell. And thanks especially to the Smith Family Foundation for providing us with financial backing, to Julie Smith for handling all our bills, and for Don Smith, who's here tonight, sitting in front, who's the guy who believed in us, took a chance at us, and who thinks he'll probably perpetuate us for at least a little bit longer. Thanks, Don. Julie Smith will soon be going on maternity leave, which is part of the reason why the Soho Forum will now be linking up with the folks at the Reason Foundation to administer our money and promote our product. Now, as you'll notice, you can pick up a free copy of the current issue of Reason. We have about 100 copies available. I personally read it cover to cover on my Kindle, partly because it often has articles by my son, Jim Epstein, one of Reason's star reporters. Now, tonight's resolution reads as follows: a market system for medical care would save more people from suffering inadequate care than any other system. Here to explain the voting procedure, our marketing director, Naomi Brockwell. Again, as Naomi's walking to the stage, I'm going to read the resolution again. A market system for medical care would save more money, more people, from suffering inadequate care than any other system. Naomi?
So for anyone who has not been here before, we do all of the voting for the debate online. So if you would take out your phone and go to sohovote.com, you'll find a page there that allows you to vote, either yes, no, or undecided. We do ask you to vote both times. Your vote will not be counted unless you vote at the start and at the end, and that's how we judge who won tonight's debate, by whoever picked up the most votes. I'm going to take this time to also encourage you all to sign up, subscribe to our YouTube channel. We do put up all of our videos about a week after each debate on there, so to keep up to date, if you enjoyed it, send it to your friends. We're also on Twitter and Facebook, so please do sign up there as well. So the website you go to again is SohoVote.com. You can vote on the resolution, and then we'll give you time at the end to vote again. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Naomi. Again, the resolution is: a market system for medical care would save more people from suffering inadequate care than any other system. While you're cogitating about that resolution, no, yes, or undecided, I want to introduce our warm-up act, the great libertarian comic Dave Smith. Dave runs the podcast that I listen to regularly called Part of the Problem and spends much of the rest of his time touring the country doing stand-up. Thank you, Dave. Now we are all warmed up, and we are about to close the voting on the resolution. A market system for medical care would save more people from suffering inadequate care than any other system. All right, Naomi, I guess we can close the voting. You've all voted on the resolution. And Michael Cannon, I think he needs no introduction, especially if you read what was in the website. He is from the Cato Institute. Jonathan Cohn, over here is from the Huffington Post. He will be arguing for the negative. Michael, you have 15 minutes to defend the proposition a market system for medical care would save more people from suffering inadequate care than any other system. Take it away, Michael.
Thank you, Gene. But I asked the comedian that he, David, that he not be funnier than me, if you could just can him for that, because I come from Washington, D.C., and so I want to thank the good people of New York for sending your finest down to be with us. That was just a really nice move. I appreciate that. And now your finest is in charge of healthcare. But let's abstract from that unpleasant reality for a moment to talk about what we all want from healthcare, which is to bring healthcare within the reach of more and more people, better healthcare, higher quality healthcare, making it more affordable with every passing day so that fewer people are falling through the cracks of our healthcare sector. And the history of American healthcare is actually a story of entrepreneurs and innovators developing new ways to make healthcare better and more affordable and more secure, of filling in the cracks of our healthcare sector so that fewer and fewer people fall through. You'd never know this, however, because that's not your experience with healthcare, and that's not my experience with healthcare. So, though, and that's because those innovations that would improve our lives, that would bring life-saving medical care within the reach of more and more people, are every day almost uniformly thwarted. And why is that? Well, there's this myth that surrounds the U.S. healthcare system that, with its runaway costs and millions of uninsured, that this is what you get when you have a market system for healthcare. This, what we have in the United States. It's held up as the paradigmatic example of how markets work in healthcare here and around the world. But on the contrary, the U.S. healthcare sector is actually what you get when you let government run rampant in healthcare. We have in the United States every type of socialized medicine you could possibly imagine. We have we give our veterans a fully socialized health care system, like the British National Health Service. The U.S. Medicare program is a different variety of single payer, where the government sets the rules and pays the bills, and we say that, and still we say that participating providers are part of the private sector. The Medicaid program is kind of like the Canadian Medicare program. It's created and funded by the national government, but administered by the states or federal governments. The U.S. government, like the German government, connects health insurance for workers to their place of employment. And now with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, we finally have a Swiss-style system where the government dictates insurance benefits and pricing and compels you to buy it. In this bastion of free market medical care, government tightly controls who can practice medicine, what education they must have, what tasks they can perform, where they can practice medicine, who can open a medical facility, who can purchase expensive medical equipment, where we purchase our health insurance, what our insurance covers, the prices we pay for insurance, how we obtain health care in retirement, what treatments doctors can prescribe, what the manufacturers can say about those treatments and their products, the organizational structure of healthcare providers, how healthcare providers get paid, how much they get paid, how much we spend on healthcare, how we help the poor obtain medical care. Government controls half our healthcare spending directly and the remainder indirectly. Government controls 51% of national health expenditures in the United States directly. By taxing that money from us and then spending it itself, it controls another 31% or more by penalizing us unless we spend our own money the way government wants, by buying the health insurance the government wants us to buy and where the government wants us to buy it. And still, everyone thinks the United States has a market system for healthcare. I like to say the greatest trick that advocates of socialized medicine ever played was to convince the American people that we don't already have it. What sets the U.S. healthcare sector apart is not the level of government involvement that we have in healthcare. It's just that here, unlike other nations that put socialized medicine on a budget, we don't. And so we get outrageously high prices combined with lots of medical care that is unnecessary at best and that often ends up killing the patient. So let's look at some of the ways that a market system would improve healthcare for everyone, filling in those cracks in our healthcare sector, making it better so that fewer and fewer people fall through. A market system would allow dental hygienists to provide more affordable dental exams and cleanings to low-income kids. Government prohibits them from doing so. A market system would allow dental therapists to provide more affordable fillings to low-income kids. Government prevents them from doing so. A market system would allow nurse practitioners and other mid-level clinicians and the companies that employ them to provide more affordable primary care to low-income families. Government prohibits them. A market system would allow licensed doctors, dentists, and other clinicians to give away free medical care to the poor, but believe it or not, government all too often prohibits them from doing so. A market system would drive down healthcare prices. Yes, I said healthcare prices, and down. Recent experiments have found that overwhelmed, bewildered, yet cost-conscious patients have been beaten employers and insurers at driving prices down. Driving prices for MRI scans down 11%, CT scans 13%, shoulder arthroscopy 17%, knee arthroscopy and cataract removal 18%, hip and knee replacement 20%, colonoscopy 21%, lab tests 32%. In California, at high-cost hospitals, they drove down the prices for hip and knee replacements by an average of 37%, a $16,000 savings, beating what the third-party payers with all of their negotiating clout could do. This is the most important assistance we can provide to the poor. It's falling prices. First of all, because it means there are fewer of them. Because the more we drive prices down, the more people can provide for themselves, and the wealthier the rest of us are, so that we have more money lying around so that we can help those who still can't help themselves. Yet government encourages excessive third-party payments so prices climb and stay outrageously high. A market system would also improve the quality of care. Markets developed so-called accountable care organizations like Kaiser Permanente and Group Health Cooperative 70 years ago. These are health systems that use electronic medical records, that allow you to email your doctor, that let you check lab results online, that provide coordinated care. They are engines of medical effectiveness research, which is essential for making sure that patients get the right care and avoid unnecessary and harmful care. When the FDA wanted to figure out whether Vioxx was hurting patients, they didn't have the data to do this themselves. They couldn't conduct the research themselves. Where did they go? They went to Kaiser Permanente of Northern California and asked if they could borrow their records and go through their medical records and see if in fact, Vioxx was hurting people. Government blocks such health systems, which is why you don't have any of them here in New York. It's why researchers lament that we don't have a solid evidence base for most of the things that doctors do. And it's why government is now struggling and failing to promote accountable care organizations and electronic medical records and coordinated care and effectiveness research itself with all of its tools of taxes and subsidies and mandates and regulation and so forth. Speaking of effectiveness research, you may have heard Speaker of the House Paul Ryan say the other day that all three of his kids got tonsillectomies from the same ENT, but he complained that the hospital charged $1,400 for his kid to sit there and watch SpongeBob SquarePants. He wants to get that price down. And by the way, his legislation won't do that. But more important, a market system might have allowed his kids to avoid what his own story suggests may have been unnecessary surgeries for his three children, from which some children die. Government keeps us in the dark and encourages dangerous, unnecessary care by blocking those engines of medical effectiveness research. And speaking of unnecessary and harmful care, researchers at Johns Hopkins University recently estimated that 250,000 patients die in the United States every year from medical errors. That would make medical errors our third leading cause of death in the United States. A market system rewards providers that find ways to reduce medical errors. Government, particularly the U.S. Medicare program, pays providers more when they injure patients and discourages them from reducing, it penalizes them when they reduce medical errors. A market system would reward providers who provide coordinated care. Government pays providers more when they provide confusing, uncoordinated care to patients. A market system would provide continuous coverage. A 2008 study found that young men with high-cost medical conditions were twice as likely to end up uninsured if they had health insurance from an employer, the kind of coverage that government promotes by creating a tax preference for employer-sponsored insurance or really effectively imposing a tax penalty on people who don't get coverage from an employer. And this is a form of insurance that disappears after people get pre-existing conditions and for no good reason disappears when you turn 18 or 26 or 65, when you change jobs, when you lose your job, when a spouse dies, when you get divorced. when the plant closes, when the company just decides to drop health benefits. Jonathan wrote an entire book about how markets fail people in this way. In fact, it's the government that's failed people in this way by pushing us all into a type of health insurance that turns what should be insured conditions into uninsurable pre-existing conditions. And a market system would make insurance protection more affordable. Same time that study came out, markets developed a new type of health insurance or a new insurance product called pre-existing conditions insurance for just 20% of the cost of an insurance policy. An 80% discount, uninsured people could buy the right to enroll in a health insurance plan of their choice. No matter how sick they got, even if they got cancer, they could enroll in that plan and pay healthy person rates. Imagine college students being able to save thousands of dollars per year while still getting secure protection from the long-term costs of expensive illnesses. Government, and specifically the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, destroyed this innovation. Government's solution to this problem has now left Melissa Nance, a 45-year-old Knoxville resident who's with an aggressive form of leukemia, and 43,000 other residents of East Tennessee with no health insurance options at all next year, because that law has driven every last insurance company from the market. The market innovations I mentioned are just the ones that we know about. There are further innovations we haven't even seen, because in healthcare, government has all but destroyed the process that makes every other aspect of our lives better with each passing year. And the harms that government causes in healthcare are not abstractions. We just passed a grim anniversary in the history of healthcare reform in the United States. It was 10 years ago on February 25th that a young boy, young Maryland boy named Diamante Driver died. Diamante Driver died from an infection that began in an abscessed tooth. That infection spread throughout his system, spread to his brain, and eventually overwhelmed his system. Diamante had two brain surgeries, spent 6 weeks in the hospital, an estimated $250,000 worth of care. It wasn't enough to save him. You know what would have saved him? An $80 tooth extraction. The Driver family was not able to find a dentist that would see Diamante and his brothers. Diamante's mother, Elise Driver, tried to find a dentist. And the local nonprofit made dozens of calls on their behalf to try to find a dentist who would accept their Medicaid coverage. That's right. They were insured. They had health insurance. They had a government guarantee of access to access to dental care through the Medicaid program. But Medicaid provides such poor access to care that guarantee wasn't worth the paper it was printed on. And so Diamante Driver died 10 years ago at age 12, the Washington Post wrote, for want of a dentist. The government made basic dental care impossible for Elise Driver and her family to afford by prohibiting dental hygienists from practicing independently and by prohibiting dental therapists from practicing at all. There are only a couple of states that allow them. And then the government gave the Driver family a guarantee of access to dental care that, in Diamante's case, as I said, wasn't worth the paper it was printed on. And what changed after Diamante's death? After Diamante's, pretty well-publicized, I don't think well-publicized enough, but in the D.C. area is a well-publicized death. What happened? Well, Maryland has not yet allowed dental hygienists to practice independently. It still doesn't allow dental therapists to practice. The Medicaid program still provides lousy access to care. And both Obamacare and the Republican repeal and replace plan create incentives for states to expand their Medicaid programs to less needy, able-bodied adults, while also creating incentives for states to reduce access to care for vulnerable kids like Diamante and other vulnerable patients. This is not what a market system looks like. In a market system, these innovations that I've been talking about fill in the cracks so that fewer people fall through them with every passing day. When you hand your healthcare sector over to the government, those cracks widen, and more people like Diamante Driver and even some of our loved ones fall through. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Jonathan Cohn, 15 minutes to speak against the resolution. Take it away, Jonathan.
Thank you. Thank you, Gene and the Soho Forum. Thank you, Michael. Michael and I have done this a couple dozen times, although I think this is our first time since King Burwell, so it's been a little while. But I'm pleased to be here. particularly grateful to be here with what I imagine is a crowd that leans a little bit in the libertarian direction. Living in our political life today, you become very aware of the fact that you spend a lot of time talking to people who think the same way that you do. This is not good for anybody. And a chance to address an audience that maybe is skeptical of the argument, or maybe skeptical of the idea that government could be better than markets for anything, is a real chance. And as we go through this, I hope you will keep an open mind. I would love to win this debate. Everybody loves to win a debate. But we are here at a very important time in this country's history. We are at a very important moment in this debate about healthcare. You all, just by virtue of being here, are people, your opinion leaders in your own communities, some of your opinion leaders in larger communities. And whether or not you end up agreeing with the resolution or disagreeing with the resolution or more or less skeptical, I hope you'll keep an open mind and think about the fact that, you know, maybe whatever you thought before, whichever side you come from, maybe you're going to rethink your principles a little bit, or rethink at least how those principles apply to healthcare. Now, I'm here to defend the proposition that markets are not the best form of healthcare to take care of everybody. And I want to be clear about how I see, I guess what you could say if we were doing debate, my burden here. Because I am not trying to convince you that markets are bad for everything. There are some things that markets do wonderfully. I'm also not trying to convince you that markets are always bad in healthcare. There are a number of ideas that Michael listed in his suggestions for what he would like to see healthcare look like. Off the top of my head, he mentioned nurse practitioners doing more, you know, loosening licensing requirements. I think there are many people who you would identify as progressive or supporting government and healthcare who would be first to sign on to that. That in general, in fact, that competition can be a very useful thing in healthcare. And in fact, a lot of reforms over the last few years are specifically designed to actually make a better marketplace. We'll get into this in a second, but if you think about the format, the structure of the Affordable Care Act, a big part of it was to try to set up a place where people could shop intelligently, to use government rules to create a more functioning market. So to believe that government has a role in healthcare is not to believe that markets have no place at all. And one more time, I'm going to reach down for this piece of paper. There we go. Now I know how to grab it. It is not to believe that. It is to believe, however, that government has an important role. An important role because perhaps healthcare is a little different. Now, Michael started with a story about American healthcare and how it's evolved. I'm also going to start with a story of American healthcare and how it's evolved. Really quick history lesson. I don't have a lot of time for this, but I think it's important. Insurance, as we know it in this country, did not exist, health insurance, that is, until the late 1920s. And the reason it came into existence was that before that time, we really had a pure market system for healthcare in this country. It's the only, Michael is right, there's never been a pure free market except for this time. And here's what happened. In the 1920s, the modern era of medicine was just getting underway, and finally, for the first time, medical care got very expensive, too much for people to actually pay their bills. And all of a sudden, hospitals and doctors, they were all going bankrupt because they would fill their wards with patients and nobody could pay the bills. And it became apparent that there needed to be some kind of group arrangement for pooling resources. This is very important. If you study healthcare, the whole key to financing healthcare is that there has to be some kind of shared arrangement for financing. Because medicine, even as early as the 1920s, was already so much more money than any individual could afford on their own, that the only way to finance medical care, the only way for people to get it, was to have a pool of people, most of whom are healthy, paying into a system so that there's enough money for the few people who are sick and generating large bills. And for a time, insurance companies actually tried to sell these policies on their own, one-on-one to people. But they found, they came up with a problem that basically the only people buying insurance in this free market were people who knew they were going to get sick. They could not make it work. There had to be some other kind of arrangement. And I mention this to highlight a few things. First of all, the economics of healthcare are different than other sectors of the economy.
They are plagued by adverse selection. They are plagued by asymmetric information. Insurance companies know less about the health of people applying for them than the people who apply for the insurance. That makes it impossible to get a balanced risk pool. And without a balanced risk pool, it's impossible to get that mix of healthy and sick people to cover everybody's bills. Healthcare is also the sheer cost of it is so overwhelming that if you left it to a purely free market system, very few people could actually afford it. And just to take an example, right now, today, I don't think most people know this because unless you've ever had to go on COBRA, most people get insurance through an employer, and they have no idea how much that insurance actually costs. But unless you've gone on COBRA, then you have to pay the whole premium. But you know, for an individual, you're talking $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 for a family, $15,000, $16,000, $20,000 a year. Now Michael would say, well, that's because we pay too much in this country. It's because we've larded up our system with all these government mandates. But even if you assume that they're a third too high, half too high, you know, so that an insurance policy covered $3,000 a year, $4,000 a year. There's a large portion of the American population that simply could not afford that. I want to say that again. If we had a pure free market system for healthcare, given the cost of healthcare, even assuming Michael is right about everything he has said about markets bringing down the cost, you are going to be left with healthcare that is vastly more money than a large section of the population can cover by themselves. And the only question is how big a section that is. Now, it so happens that after the 1920s, most of the world at that point said, you know what? What we really need to do is to get everybody into one pool, create a universal healthcare system, have the government organize it, have the government set budgets. We did not. We basically did this kind of haphazard thing where we organized insurance around employers, and then eventually we brought in Medicare and Medicaid, and more recently we brought in the Affordable Care Act. That gives us two sets of experiments here, and they're very crude. I don't want to make this sound more scientific than it is, but we do sort of have two case studies where we can compare a system that's less market to more market. We can compare how Europe is to the United States, and we can compare how the United States is before the Affordable Care Act and after the Affordable Care Act. So what do we know? Well, here's what we know about Europe. Number one, even though they spend less money than we do, they have much better access to care. And you can measure this. There are surveys on this. There are studies. I brought a few up here with me. I'm not going to go through the numbers. You're welcome to look at them later if you want. But when it comes to like questions like how many people have trouble getting access to care because of money, the United States is an outlier. We have way more than any other country, developed country in the world. Cost-related access to problems in those countries are just far less prevalent. And if you go to some of the Scandinavian countries, they're practically non-existent. All right, people say, yeah, but you have to wait so long to get services. You know, I remember I had my cousin in England or whatever. Well, you know what? It is true. In some countries, you have to wait longer for services, but in some, you don't. And in fact, when you look at access to care, and you look at waiting periods, and you look at access, the United States is often worse than some of these countries. They are worse, certainly, almost across the board when it comes to primary care. But even on specialist care, the United States is, you know, everyone, there's this assumption, you can see a specialist faster in the United States. Well, some people can. Many people can. And if you average it all out, actually, wait times for specialists in the United States is not that great. But what about quality? That's what you always hear about. Isn't the quality of care worse in those countries? Well, it's not showing up on the statistics. You know, there is a statistic called mortality amenable to healthcare that's crude. It is crude and it counts a bunch of other things, but it's not a bad way to start. And mortality amenable to healthcare in the United States is worse than almost all the European countries. And while there's a lot of variation, for example, Britain isn't that good because they tend not to spend a lot of money on healthcare. If you go to countries like Switzerland or France or Sweden, they blow us away. So they are getting better healthcare to more people than the United States. Now, it is true, the United States today, as Michael says, has Medicare and the VA, and we do a lot of regulation. But really, do we really think that's more government than what they have in Sweden? Do we really think that's more government than what they have in France? Maybe we have a lot of government, but if you're trying to compare more market, less market, I think it's pretty clear those European nations have more market, and I think they're getting better results. Now, what about here in the United States? What about what we know about extending government programs like Medicaid, like the Affordable Care Act? We have pretty good data on this, too. There have been a number of experiments on the on the role of these programs. And what they find is that universally, extending government insurance, when you extend government insurance, it improves financial security. It reduces barriers to care. It increases access to care. This is not ambiguous. There is great statistical data on this. The two best are studies from Oregon and Massachusetts, published in the last few years in the journal New England Journal of Medicine and the Annals of Internal Medicine. And in both cases, they found better access to care, less financial distress, more use of care. Now, the one question these two very important studies differed on was, are people actually ending up healthier? And the study in Oregon actually found, no, actually people for the most part were not ending up healthier, except on mental health, which, by the way, is health. But on non-mental health, they did not find improvement. The Massachusetts study did. Now, I think for various reasons, if you look at the whole literature, it's pretty clear that insurance actually does make you healthier. But let's put that aside. Even if that were not true, the mere fact that extending coverage helps people, makes them financially secure, increases access, that tells you a lot. And we now have data on the Affordable Care Act, which Dave, I know, was that the comedian's name? Dave?
Yes.
Yes, Dave, I know, said was, I forget what he said, it was terrible and such. You know, look, I could sit here for an hour and tell you everything that is wrong with the Affordable Care Act, because there's a lot of problems with the Affordable Care Act. What I can also tell you is that 20 million people got health insurance. And yes, that getting insurance to 20 million people improved access, it reduced financial barriers to care, it reduced people reporting that they didn't take their medicines because they couldn't afford it. Again, this is something we have studied. There's data. There was a paper in the Journal of American Medical Journal of the American Medical Association just about a year ago, really comprehensive, looked at all the data, did a regression, even accounted for things like the fact that, you know, the economy has been getting better since the Affordable Care Act took place. So you would expect access to improve. But even accounting for that, they found that access improved. And, I mean, it's common sense. If you're going to get more people insured and you're going to give them a way to get to see the doctor or the hospital, more of them are going to get better care. Now, Michael mentioned the story of DeMonte Diver, and we all know that story. It was a very highly publicized story. It was a terrible story. And to give you the background here, this is a problem with Medicaid. Medicaid frequently pays so little that it's hard to see a specialist. But ask yourself this question. If we were in a market system, would he have gotten to see the dentist? I mean, he didn't have insurance otherwise. And obviously couldn't pay out of pocket, or they would have paid out of pocket in the first place. We know for a fact that overall, giving people insurance helps them to get care. We know that because of Medicaid, people are getting better access. We know that because of the Affordable Care Act, more people are getting to see the doctor, and more people are getting to see, getting into the hospital when they need to. You know, I've interviewed people like this, too. I came to this, I started doing all this years ago when I wrote this book that Michael knows about. And I spent a long time interviewing people and asking them what, you know, about their healthcare situation. And I can tell you that, you know, when you hear these statistics about the number of Americans without insurance, the number of Americans going bankrupt, these are real stories. They are out there. And these are people who, a lot of them, some of them are poor, some of them are not so poor. They don't have insurance, and then they can't get in to see a doctor, or they go bankrupt trying to see one. Now, having the government give people insurance, help people to pay for insurance, has not made that problem go away by any stretch of the imagination. But has it made it better? I think that's absolutely clear. And I can tell you, talking to people in the last month who are afraid of losing that coverage right now, they all say the same thing. They said, if it wasn't for the insurance I've gotten, what would I do? How would I pay for this medical care that's thousands of dollars? I could never pay for that on my own. The fact is, markets do a lot of things very well. They do a lot of things in healthcare very well, and I'm not here to deny that. But I think it is simply unrealistic to think that we could have a system where medicine is this expensive, a market system that would provide for everybody except for a fraction of the people in this population. And given what the resolution is, what provides for the most people, I think it's pretty clear that if you have a pure market system, if you don't have a big role for government, we know from common sense, we know from our experience that having the government play a big role, having the government help people to get insurance, will lead to more people getting care, more people being healthy, and ultimately a better healthcare system.
Now, 5 minutes of rebuttal from the affirmative, Michael Cannon.
Thank you, Jonathan. I think of one of the big differences between Jonathan and me, our perspectives on healthcare, is how much of the outrageous prices that we see in the U.S. healthcare sector do we attribute to government and do we attribute to markets? And I would argue that Jonathan underappreciates the effect that all these interventions that we've talked about, all these ways that the government gets involved in healthcare, have driven up healthcare prices. It begins with driving up prices for Elise and Diamante driver to get in for a basic dental cleaning. It begins with that because if they can get in the door, then it becomes actually a lot easier for them to afford the whatever care her boys might need for their teeth, because if a dental hygienist sees a boy with an abscess like Diamante, she grabs his hand and she says, I'm not letting go of this hand until you get in to see a dentist, and we'll worry about paying for that later. Do I know that deregulation would save Diamante driver? I would not ever argue that any system is going to prevent everyone from falling through the cracks. But that's where the rising prices begin, and then it gets worse when the government encourages more health insurance than people would purchase on their own. Health insurance is a wonderful innovation. It is one of the most amazing innovations, or insurance broadly, but health insurance in particular, that human beings have ever devised. It's an innovation where strangers pay medical bills for complete strangers and do so voluntarily, or at least they used to do so voluntarily. And the fact that they're doing it all really out of self-interest just makes it all the more amazing, because insurance channels the self-interest of individuals to do an unquestionably compassionate thing, which is to provide life-saving medical care to strangers. But insurance also has costs. One of the costs, the big cost of insurance, is that it's called moral hazard. When you are more heavily insured, you care less about prices, and you care less about even the quality of care that you're receiving. You don't scrutinize even that as much as you would if you were paying the bills yourself. And so what ends up happening, and there's lots of research to document this, is that prices go up and utilization goes up, as Jonathan mentioned, when you use healthcare, when you are more heavily insured. But all these coverage expansions that Jonathan has been talking about, and these include not just government programs, but this tax preference for employer-sponsored insurance, push the amount of insurance that we use well beyond the point where the benefits of risk protection swamp the cost of moral hazard. And we're out in the territory where the costs of moral hazard are driving up prices so much, both because they're driving up medical prices, but also because it's driving up unnecessary utilization, which increases health insurance premiums, that healthcare prices, I would argue, are much higher than the effect that government has on healthcare prices are much higher than Jonathan would argue, and the prices in a market system would be much lower than Jonathan recognizes. And the figures that I gave you before are really just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, a 37% reduction in hip and knee replacement prices at these high-priced hospitals. The researchers who conducted this study said, we think they could get the prices down much farther. I mean, have any of you examined the hospital bills that you got or the explanation of benefits? Have you seen those ridiculous list prices that unfortunately some people end up paying? Because they don't know that those are ridiculous prices, and that they can negotiate those down often. We will get those much lower, I think, when people are spending their own money instead of the government spending their money. I'm glad that Jonathan mentioned the Oregon health insurance experiment, because this gets to the question of it gets to the question of moral hazard and what are we getting for all of this money that we're taxing from people to provide health insurance subsidies to others. Yes, when you expand Medicaid to able-bodied adults, financial security improves. There are improvements in mental health. But it was a shocking and astounding finding that the Oregon health insurance experiment, which randomly assigned some low-income adults to get Medicaid and others to get nothing. It was a shocking finding that there are no improvements in physical health outcomes. We do not know what we're spending for all, or what we're getting for all the money we're spending on these programs. And so, yes, the ACA may have expanded Medicaid. I think the number is actually more like 10 million people in Medicaid and maybe five or so and through the exchanges. But we may have expanded Medicaid to 10 million more able-bodied adults, but we have no idea what we're purchasing for all that money. Well, we do know that the Medicaid program does drive up prices in the private sector.
Thank you. So first of all, I'm glad that you acknowledge that insurance increases financial security. To me, that's a very big deal. I think most of us have insurance for that reason. I'm willing to bet most people in this room have health insurance for that reason. You know, the other day, today actually, it was Sunday also, there were members of the Trump administration who were, you know, they were anticipating this bad CBO score. They're like, oh, you know, who needs that card, that little shiny plastic card that says you have insurance? And I'm like, I'm willing to bet each of you guys has one of those shiny plastic cards, and I bet you like it. And I bet you value it because medical care, if you can't pay for it, it can ruin you, or you might have to make that awful decision that you're not going to get the medical care you need because you can't pay for it. I want to talk, you've mentioned DeMonte Diver a couple times. I want to mention two other people. A couple years ago when I was in Los Angeles, I met a man named Tony Montenegro. He was a security guard at a firm, and he had eye problems. He was an immigrant from El Salvador. And he had diabetes, and he got complications, and he couldn't go see a doctor because he couldn't afford to. He had no insurance. He had no way to pay for it. And eventually the care, you know, he needed, he had severe eye problems. And the thing was, he was making about $15,000 a year. So $15,000 a year, he didn't have money for insurance. He didn't have money for even what most of us would consider pretty routine medical care. There's no way he could have gotten that on his own. Now, a couple months ago, I was back in California. I met a woman named Mary Ann Hammers. Now, Mary Ann Hammers is in her early 60s. She's a freelance editor and writer. She's been relatively healthy for most of her life. She's got cancer now, ovarian cancer. She was diagnosed at stage 3. In the last year and a half, she's gone through two separate rounds of surgery, recovery, chemo. Her medical bills are now approaching $1 million. Now, over the course of her lifetime, she's not making $1 million. She's never going to be able to pay for that. Now, Michael is here telling you that, well, if the prices were lower, if we didn't have all this government mucking up the prices, then, you know, they could afford it. Do you really think that's possible for someone with that kind of cancer in today's technology? I mean, let's assume we cut that in half, 50%. Do we really expect people to pay for that kind of thing? The fact is that medicine has become very expensive. And largely, in many ways, that's a good thing. I mean, there's sort of a joke we make in healthcare policy circles, which is that, you know, would you prefer 1950s medicine at 1950s prices? And most people say no, because we're much better at treating things now. We've gotten much better at cardiac care and cancer care. And finally, belatedly, we're also learning that, gee, you know, if you actually really focus on preventative care and upfront care, keeping people healthy, that's even better if we can do that. So we're learning that finally. So we've gotten pretty good at that stuff. But it costs a lot of money. And it costs a lot of money, even if you can imagine the most efficient models. It costs a lot of money, even if you can imagine a magical marketplace that's going to reduce everything by 50%. It's going to cost more money than a lot of people can afford. That is a fact of life. It is arithmetic. And so when you say we should have a market system, if you're going to have a market system without government playing some substantial role in helping those people to get health insurance or health care, if you don't have insurance, fine, just want to pay it straight. Well, then just remember, you are telling 10, 15, 20, 25% of the population, you're not getting care. You're not going to be able to afford it if you get really sick. And that's what we're talking about here. That's what a pure market system would do.
Yeah. Oh,
I got one more minute. Okay.
50 seconds.
50 seconds. And so, you know, when you're thinking about this and you're thinking about the role that government plays, again, it doesn't have to be a purely socialist system. It doesn't have to be what they have in Sweden. Although, let me tell you something. Having talked to people from Sweden, they would tell you they're much happier with their system than we are with ours, and they get much better results overall. But you don't have to imagine that. You don't have to imagine a system where nurse practitioners can't do more. Again, I think that's something that many progressives would support. You don't have to imagine a system where the tax system gives incentive for extra insurance. You know, the Affordable Care Act actually tries to ratchet that tax preference back. But the point is, at some point, unless you're willing to take a significant portion of the population and say they're going to be at the mercy of charity and probably many of them end up in distress, then you are looking at a system where government is going to play a substantial role. That is a function of the cost and the unique economics of healthcare.
Thank you, Jonathan. Okay, before we go over to audience questions, you each got a question to ask of each other. Michael, do you have a question for Jonathan? Well, pick up your microphone, please, and ask the question.
So, Jonathan, you wrote a book about how private insurance shortchanges the sick. And by the way, that's the name of the book, Sick. Look for it in your local bookstore. Most of the examples you cite are people who are enrolled in employer-sponsored insurance. So because, as I mentioned before, the government effectively penalizes people if they don't enroll in employer-sponsored insurance. And then they found their insurance disappeared after they developed an expensive medical condition. Hasn't government spent the last 70 years turning what should be insured conditions into uninsurable pre-existing conditions? And aren't the examples in your book evidence that government is incompetent at doing healthcare, that it actually makes things worse when it gets involved?
So, first of all, thank you for the book plug, and I don't want to seem rude given that lovely book plug, but I actually don't think that's what the story is in the book show. The first story is about someone who had employer health insurance, and the problem is they lost their job, which is what happens when you have employer health insurance. One person had an employer policy, but the insurer, it had nothing to do with being an employer policy. It was that the insurer, looking to save money, had found a way to sort of avoid taking care of certain categories of illness. Pre-existing conditions existed. That came about on its own. If you remember the sort of, and I know you know this history, but I mean, the reason the whole pre-existing conditions issue came up was that as insurers were trying to sell one to individuals on their own outside of employers, they quickly realized they ran into that problem I talked about at the beginning, which is that the people who came and wanted insurance were people who were tended to be in poor health, and insurers were losing a lot of money on them. And so they said, all right, we're going to have to start screening people. I mean, to be fair to the insurers, in that kind of market, this is the adverse selection problem. This is exactly my point. If you create a system where insurance is being sold directly to people, individuals, they are naturally going to look for people to exclude. They're going to look for the worst risks and do their best to avoid covering them. Or at the very least, if they have to cover those people, they're going to look to avoid paying really extreme medical bills. And it's financial survival. It's the logic of the market. They're doing what they should to be responsible to their shareholders. The problem is being responsible to their shareholders leaves people who need medical care in the lurch.
Jonathan, ask a question of Michael.
Okay. So, Michael, tell me, in your system, actually describe what your ideal system, paint me a picture of what actually your ideal healthcare system looks like. You're king for a day, snap your fingers, what does American healthcare look like?
As I mentioned before, you've got a lot fewer people falling through the cracks than you do in either this system that we have right now, the one we had before the Affordable Care Act, or I think in any other country. And the main reason is because of something I think you underplay the significance of, which is falling prices. The more prices fall, every other problem that you face in healthcare becomes easier. The more prices fall, like they do for these things and everything else, the more people can provide for themselves, and the easier it is for the rest of us to provide for those who still cannot provide for themselves, who still can't afford the health insurance and medical care that they need. And not only that, but because the government is not getting involved in ways it suppresses medical research, we know more about what works. And so we know if the woman you mentioned in Los Angeles, is getting the best care that she can. She's getting care that's going to be effective. We're going to we'll be able to steer people away from ineffective forms of chemo for certain, you know, for certain cancers toward more effective treatments. So not only will the prices be lower and we'll better able to help people who can't afford that care themselves, but the care itself will be better. We'll be avoiding unnecessary surgeries like maybe Paul Ryan's three kids had. We'll be avoiding all sorts of medical errors because we will have more health systems that internalize the cost of those errors rather than just pass them on to the taxpayer who ends up subsidizing those errors. We'll have more people, fewer people falling through the cracks that way. And access to healthcare will be more secure because I disagree with your categorization of how health insurance markets work. I don't think it's adverse selection that you're describing. I think it's pricing. Adverse selection is when you have what the Affordable Care Act put in place, which is price controls on health insurance that says insurers cannot charge healthy and sick people of a given age different premiums, and that's what causes adverse selection. And that's what's causing the market to collapse in East Tennessee so that Melissa Nance, who's got leukemia, never mind. I mean, she is going to be facing that $1 million chemotherapy bill all by herself. And that's because of the instability that the ACA injected into that market. And there are 3 million people around the country in counties that only have one insurer left in the market who may be in the same spot. When the government lets insurance companies price according to risk, you don't get adverse selection. The market is stable, and the market can cover as many people as it can and makes insurance protection more affordable with the pre-existing conditions insurance and other innovations that I mentioned. And it shrinks the number of people who cannot afford the medical care that they need, makes that number as small as possible, and again saves us money so that we're better able to help those.
I want to take a moderator's privilege to ask a question of each of the debaters. Michael Cannon, since you touched on the issue that Jonathan raised, I believe that Jonathan Cohn said that they tried selling health insurance to people in the 1920s. But the market failed, that in no country could you really sell health insurance to people because of the problems he stated. Could you address that question directly?
The market didn't fail. They were selling health insurance to people. What they tried to do initially was to sell health insurance without adjusting the premiums according to the risk of the individual applicant. And an insurance market can't work that way. For the same reason, you can't have an insurance market where people can buy home insurance or fire insurance after their house is already burned down. If you want that market to work, you can't let people wait until after a loss occurs to buy insurance. Now, does that mean if your neighbor's house burns down, you don't help your neighbor? No, of course not. It means you don't destroy the insurance market as a way to help them, because that ends up not helping. You let the insurance markets do as much good as they possibly can, and then you find other ways to subsidize people who cannot afford the medical care that they need.
Yeah, that segues into the question I wanted to put to you, Jonathan. In what way are you saying something other than the following? That if, for example, people push for a voucher program in schools, we have food stamps for food. And so you are talking about people who won't, you can seem to concede the possibility that medical care costs could be brought down considerably. You said, let's say they're halved. Obviously, if none of us can afford it, then we'll all die. But clearly, we need some redistribution, as you indicate. In what way are you talking about something other than something similar to the food stamp program or vouchers program, where people who can't quite afford it are subsidized by the rest of us, and then otherwise the market sorts it out? Is that a system that you would endorse?
So just to be clear, I was conceding the sort of get down the prices by half as a debater's, you know, okay. To be clear, I don't actually think you could get them down by half. Okay. My point was that if you could, even if you could get them down by half, which I should have made clear, I don't actually think you could, you would still have a problem. So that's just to be clear about that. Okay. In terms of what you are saying, look, I mean, the problem with healthcare financing, a very crude way to think about it, is there are people who get sick and their care costs a lot of money. And unless their name is Bill Gates, they're not going to be able to pay for it. I mean, that is the basic reality of healthcare. And again, if you want to believe that the market can get the price down a quarter, a half, all right. So now we're saying that basically only people who make, you know, over $150,000 a year can pay for it, which is not a very large part of the country. So you have to pay for that. what you're saying, I think, if I understand you, is that why not have an insurance system that basically basically a free market insurance system where
food
people,
stamps, vouchers,
yeah, and then
food stamps,
we vouchers. Provide charity. You know, we have some government program to just fill in the gaps. It's vouchers or whatever.
Yes.
Well, you know, that is not so dissimilar from the way Medicaid works, right? I mean, what is Medicaid? Medicaid is basically giving insurance to people who can't get it on their own. If you actually, I mean, there are theoretically any number of ways to get that money to the people. But keep in mind, the money is the same. That money is still being spent. And that program you describe, where there are vouchers, those are very big vouchers. They are very expensive. That is not Michael's market system. That is a different kind of government-run healthcare system. I don't happen to think it's the best. I mean, I think if you're really going to start from scratch and go on the board and say, well, what system works the best? I do think something that looks like one of the European systems, where you have the government providing a baseline of insurance for everybody, a fairly thin baseline, and then you let people buy up from that, and you provide extra coverage for people who can't afford on their own. That, to me, would be, you know, on paper, that looks like the best. But what you describe is not, you know, doesn't sound crazy to me, but it doesn't also sound like a market system. It sounds like one with a lot of government spending, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's what Michael agrees with. I don't know. But to me, that doesn't sound like a market system. That sounds like one where government is still spending a ton of money. It's just sort of channeling it to people in a different way.
All right, 25 minutes for questions from the audience. Please ask a question. Try to avoid statements and speeches. You'll get a chance to speak to these people after the debate. So take your question, please.
My question is directed to Jonathan. You mentioned the early history of insurance, but you make no reference to the fraternal organizations and lodges that provided coverage to millions of people in this country, as well as independent hospitals and, you know, free medical care.
Sure. No, I mean, look, when insurance started, there were, I don't know if it was millions. It was a pretty small portion. It might have been millions, probably right, but it was a small portion of the population. I mean, we've always, you know, there were fraternal organizations that provided coverage to their members. We had that. And there were certainly hospitals that provided charity. I mean, you can, the free market doesn't ignore, the free market systems don't ignore need altogether, and I would never say that. There is always charity. There are always Good Samaritans. There are always doctors who will hang a shingle out and say, yes, please, I will take care of you. There are hospitals that pride themselves on this as their mission. My problem is that historically we have found they are just woefully inadequate to the demand. There just aren't enough of them. There's not enough people. And as healthcare gets more and more expensive, that gap between what charity can provide and what people need just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Do you want to comment, Michael, on the question? No.
Only to say that I think Jonathan underappreciates the role the government is playing in driving up those prices, and that's where most of that, the role that government plays in exacerbating that unmet need.
Next question.
I was impressed by a PBS show on the medical system in Singapore, and they claim it's about 3-4% of GDP. It's a fraction of what we spend. But they rely heavily on medical savings accounts. And they showed this guy who was about 80 years old, and he had $150,000 equivalent dollars in a savings account. And the doctor said, look, you know, you got something really serious here. We can operate. You may die on the table. Maybe we can extend your life 6 months, maybe a year at most. Or if you just want to keep living and take your chances, you got $150,000 you can give your kids. And I think what we're really missing on this, if the numbers are right, like 80% of all medical care costs is in the last 2 years of your life. We're basically treating people who are going to die, and we think that's compassionate. But maybe if it was their own money and they could leave it to their kids through medical savings account, they might make other choices.
Who wants to address that? Yeah.
So one of the things that... One of the things that Jonathan and I probably agree on is that in the Medicare program in the United States, we're spending a lot of money on medical care that does not make the patient any healthier or any happier. The best estimates are that one out of every $3 that the Medicare program spends does not make the patient healthier or happier. This is a $600 billion program. And so we're talking about $200 billion per year. It's an awful lot just to take from taxpayers and give to healthcare providers for providing no benefit whatsoever. And that's one of that's the moral hazard problem that I described in healthcare before. If they were, or in health insurance before, if you gave seniors the money, then they'd be in the same situation as these folks in Singapore. They would more often be able to say, you know what, I don't think that procedure is worth it for me. I'm 95 years old. I don't want to get a hip replacement. I don't want to have a quadruple bypass surgery. Even though Medicare will pay for it, I understand. No, I'd rather spend that money going on a cruise around the world with my kids or paying for my grandchildren's education or something like that. And I you know, the Singapore system can help weed out a lot of that unnecessary medical care by giving the patient an incentive, a financial incentive, to weigh the costs and benefits of that care and decide when it's not worth it in a way the Medicare system does not. I don't think you're going to get the price competition in Singapore that you would otherwise get with patients controlling the money, because my understanding is the government controls the prices there, so you don't get that sort of price competition. But if I could be king for a day, one of the things that I might do might be not to voucherize the Medicare program, because I don't think that's liberalizing it enough. I would like to social securitize the Medicare program so that instead of giving seniors a government-defined package of benefits where the government where we're anesthetizing them from the cost of all the care that they consume, and the government is basically running the healthcare sector through the Medicare program, the government would just give seniors the cash. Give low-income seniors and seniors with a higher disease burden bigger Medicare checks, so they could all afford a standard package of insurance benefits. But then don't make them buy insurance with it. Let them decide what to do with that money. And I think you would see prices falling dramatically, and you would see seniors avoiding an awful lot of the wasteful care that occurs not just in the last 2 years of life, but throughout their tenure in the program.
Comment, Jonathan?
Yeah. So there are like four things going on with that question. I'm going to go through them real quickly. First thing is, as Michael says, Singapore comes up a lot in conversations. What you never hear about Singapore when they talk about their 3% and 4% are that they heavily regulate prices. They have a system of basically free primary care clinics that are funded directly by the government. And by the way, no one really knows if you can trust their numbers, because the government of Singapore is said to be fairly not the most honest and open and transparent. So Singapore may or may not be saving a lot of money, but if they are, they may or may not be doing it because they're regulating prices much more aggressively than we do in this country. The concept of cost sharing, the concept of skin in the game, which is something that originally you hear about from conservatives, is actually something that you'll find a lot of progressives actually agree with. Again, that is not mutually inconsistent with a government system. Again, the systems that I often talk about as having the best performance are places like France, where basically what they do is they guarantee you a fairly minimal level of set of insurance, and then they let people buy up if they want to, which is actually a lot like Medicare. Now, the catch is, as Michael knows, is that it turns out that when you get to particularly the elderly, most people want that insurance. That this is a problem, and I always sort of wonder what my libertarian friends think about this, that when you get to seniors, you know, they want that extra protection. They really do. They're very afraid of getting sick and having to pay those bills. Your point about end-of-life care, I think, is very important. I think it is more about our medical culture. I think that is a medical culture issue. We have a very interventionist culture. We have a very do-whatever-it-takes culture. And there's a lot of literature on this. There's a lot of work, important work being done. I think about having these conversations about what do we really want end-of-life to look like. And it's a complicated subject. I think that's not something that has less to do with the financing system, I think, and more to do with culture. I do, though, I guess, and this is a values choice, and obviously anybody can, you know, this is perfectly reasonable debate for people to have, but if you're talking about a system like you were describing, you are basically saying that, well, you know, someone who's, you know, again, Bill Gates, they can spend whatever they want, because, you know, if they spend an extra million or 2 million at the end of their life, what does it matter? Someone who, you know, is wealthy will have those choices, whereas people who aren't are basically going to be forced into some tough decisions. And people who are really indigent, I mean, what's that going to be like for them? You know, let's say they have a small amount of savings. They're, you know, this is what they have to pass on to their family, and, you know, you're going to ask them to make that decision. You're going to ask their kids to make that decision. Some people, you know, that may, you know, you might think that's fine and that's perfectly reasonable. I think a lot of people wouldn't be comfortable with that. So, I mean, there is a values decision there. I think it's very important as a society we think about what end of life is like. I do think we do intervene a lot. We do prolong life when it's not necessarily in the best interest of the patients, let alone the system. But making that a decision about money, I think, is a very different question.
Next question. Thank you.
I just want to comment. On my deathbed, I don't want my kids, you know, I'm sure they're going to say, if the government's paying for it, do whatever you can to save him. I want him to live as long as I can. If they had a medical savings account where they could get the money, they'd say, we don't want him to suffer.
Pull the plug. He's led a good life.
This question is for Jonathan. You mentioned that markets are not good at pooling and pricing risk, and I'm wondering if you would deny the existence of annuity markets and if you would deny the existence of life insurance markets, which are for the most part free marketly determined.
Are you an annuity denier?
I am not. I will not deny them once or twice or how many times are you supposed to? Three times? Deny? No, I wouldn't deny any of those. I would say they're different. I would say it's a different set of values. Whether people have life insurance or annuities is a very different question than whether they have access to medical care.
Comment on that question?
And I think that Jonathan's criticism would be that, not that insurance markets don't price according to risk, but that they do, and that they do it too well, because that creates a barrier to people with expensive medical conditions who might like to have health insurance to pay their medical bills. I think that prohibiting them from pricing according to risk is what destroys markets like in East Tennessee and maybe in another 1,000 counties around the country.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, it's the consequences that I'm arguing here. I mean, the consequences of having a sort of risk-priced annuity market or life insurance market is very different from the consequences of a risk-priced medical insurance market. You know, it's different to denying people, telling people they can have an annuity or life insurance is different from telling people they can't get medical care when they need it.
But there is a bit of a nirvana fallacy in that argument, because if you say, oh, well, if people, if insurers price according to risk, some people won't get insurance and they won't be able to afford the medical care that they need. So we can't let them do that, as if not letting them do that is some sort of nirvana where people get the health care they need. And what we're seeing happening in the ACA's exchanges is that is not the case. Is the market collapsing in those 16 counties in East Tennessee, leaving 43,000 people without a source of insurance for next year, and it might happen to another 3 million people in another 1,000 counties. But at Harvard, some researchers at Harvard and UT Austin have looked at the exchanges and found that those very provisions, the ban on underwriting, penalizes insurance companies for offering high-quality coverage to the sick. And so the quality of care in the exchanges is eroding as ACA architects knew it would, because they put all sorts of things in the law to try to stop that from happening, and they're not working. So there is no nirvana here. You can't just ban market prices and expect that people are going to get medical care.
So just to jump in on that real quick. So, I mean, well, I don't think we want to make this all about ACA and the state of the exchanges. But, I mean, for the record, there are actually a lot of states where it's working very well. The California market's very stable. I live in Michigan. The Michigan market is very stable. There are a lot of states where it is not stable. Tennessee, North Carolina, Arizona, they're having real problems. There are reasons there are problems in Arizona and Tennessee and North Carolina, but not California and Michigan. I would say this, and I don't want to make this a debate about the ACA. I think proof of concept is in those states where it's working. So the question is, why is it not working in those other states, and what can be done? I think there are, you know, if you're going to talk about this, I mean, there are things you could do to the law to shore it up so that the states where it's not working look more like the states where it is working. But the idea that you can't do this, that you can't have regulated, a regulated insurance market where you have community rating, which is charging everyone the same rate regardless of medical condition. Well, I just think that's demonstrably not true, because it's working in a lot of states.
Well, but by working, you mean not collapsing.
No, I mean working. No.
Because the Harvard and UT researchers found the coverage is getting worse everywhere, so that patients with MS and cancer and arthritis and infertility and other expensive conditions, and this is a quote from them, cannot be adequately insured in the exchanges. The collapse of the exchanges is just the logical conclusion of that erosion of coverage.
So I don't want to get
and
into the weeds
of the... And it happens in the
Swiss
system where they have this... Where it's basically Obamacare. It happens in the Swiss system as well, this erosion of coverage.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, I have my issues with the UT study in terms of what states they picked out and the way they adjusted it. And then you get really into the weeds here. But, again, I mean, we have good data from California. We have good data from Massachusetts. We got good results in those states. And people, I mean, there's better health. There's better financial security, better access to care. I don't concede. We're not going to settle this here. I certainly do not concede that they're simply not collapsing. I would argue that in those states, the record is strong, not just on financial security issues, but also on health outcomes issues.
Question.
Yes, my question is for Jonathan. You mentioned that there is variety in the way that the European health systems work. And so, for example, if we look at the systems that have the highest patient satisfaction year after year, they are countries like Netherlands that have the most free market-oriented systems in Europe. So in Netherlands, for example, they have a very basic universal coverage that's funded by the government, paid by the government, but then an extremely rich supplemental market. That's also true in France, which has Medicare for all type system. Even in Canada, 80% of Canadians buy supplemental insurance. It's still only a 70-30 public-private split in Canada. And so in the United States, so my question is, in the United States, we've gone away from a more free market system under ACA because the expansion in coverage has come about largely through expansion of Medicaid. Not through Medicaid, which, like Indian Health Service, VA, these are pockets of single-payer care in the United States. And so my question is, why would we view this as positive when the systems that have the greatest patient satisfaction are the ones that are going more toward a free market type system in terms of the insurance market? Why would we not want to have a more expansive insurance market where there's much richer supplemental plans that could be offered than what is possible under the ACA?
So if your point is that we should have the best system in the world is something that looks like the Dutch system or the French system even, and if conceding that would concede this debate, then I concede this debate. I think statistically those two systems you mentioned, Dutch, French system, are two of the ones I've studied pretty closely. And they have terrific results. They're very different, by the way, in terms of their spending levels. The French, both of them have a kind of basic insurance level, and then you can then top off. And in the French system, you're basically placed into these sickness funds, which are basically more or less government programs. They're just not that in name because they're technically independent. Whereas in Netherlands, you actually have a market more like what they tried to create with the ACA, where you shop for coverage. But these are both very highly regulated systems. I mean, the government's regulating the prices. The government's heavily subsidizing the markets in each of them. This model that you have in mind where there's a baseline that the government provides and then people decide how to top it off, I think is actually a very common model you see in a lot of countries. And again, I think you would find a lot of people who are, progressive in favor of government health insurance would endorse that model. In a lot of ways, that is kind of the theory of the Affordable Care Act in the sense that government guarantees people buying coverage kind of a bronze or silver level. And then if people want more generous coverage, they want to cover more of their expenses, they can buy up to gold or platinum. So that is not still a government model. I would say my argument would be that if you sort of imagine a spectrum, and this is a little hard because it's not a single spectrum like this, but, here's market, Michael's over there. So here's market, here's government, right? So I would say the European systems are over here, the U.S. is over here. U.S. has moved a little more over here, but we're still way over, more market, less government than these European systems here. So I would say, directionally it's true. The European systems are, the American system is moving in that direction. But it's still a much more, I would argue, and actually I would be curious if Michael agrees with this. Would you say that relative to the European systems, this is more of a market system? And I don't know. Maybe you don't. I would assume you would, but not to turn on you. But
not anymore.
Really?
And in fact, I would have said that even before the ACA that we were comparable to other nations, but we had at least one market in the United States, one insurance market, I should say, where you had some flexibility in terms of benefits, where consumers had some modicum of choice, where you had market prices, so insurers could price according to risk, and people could respond to those price signals. And insurers responded to those price signals by doing really amazing things. They developed a type of insurance called guaranteed renewability that says you enroll while you're healthy, and even if you get cancer, you still pay healthy patient premiums. It made healthcare access to healthcare for the sick a lot more secure than it was before. You know, an innovation almost rivaling the creation of health insurance. They created what I mentioned before, pre-existing conditions insurance, which came onto the market in 2008 and 2009. And if they quoted you a health insurance premium of $5,000, you didn't have to enroll in it right then. You could pay $1,000 instead and buy the right to enroll in that plan anytime you want, even if you got cancer in the meantime. Again, filling in those cracks in our healthcare sector, we're making access to healthcare more secure, allowing people to save thousands of dollars along the way so that they can, you know, invest that in education and improve their ability to pay for the medical care they need when eventually they get sick. When we lost that was, I think a huge loss, not just for freedom, but for our understanding of how markets and health insurance and healthcare work. You might say lauded, you might say castigated by your former employer, the New Republic. They called me Obamacare's single most relentless antagonist. They didn't mean it as a compliment. Everyone at Cato thought it was a compliment, but...
It was win-win.
But yeah, it was win-win. But the reason that I did all the stuff for which they gave me that honorific was because I'm so desperate to get that individual market back so that we can see even more innovations in health insurance design and new health insurance products that make healthcare more secure.
Thank you. Next question.
Hi there. I love the Soho Forum. I'm glad you guys do this every month. I come every time I possibly can.
Thank you.
I'm an active duty military, and I don't know that the VA is as socialist as you want to call it. I have to pay every year. And if that's your way to sell a government program, I'd suggest going to the VA. Ideas so good they have to be mandated, right? So I'm wondering, in the free market world, how does it fit in that we could have, for instance, like Dr. David Orr is in the Lower East Side, operating not-for-profit community clinics for people who work in the hospitality industry especially? That's something that obviously is a boon for people who don't have a lot of income here in the city particularly, and I just wonder how you might address that. Thanks.
I'm not sure what the question was. I was really hoping the question would be about the VA because I could do a whole hour on the VA. And not just criticizing it, because I don't have an ideological objection to the VA because it's a government benefit for government employees. I just think that it's done in a really lousy way that gets a lot of soldiers killed, never mind in the lousy care we often provide to vets. But if I understand your question, it's about how do we encourage that sort of model where people are providing lower cost care to low income people? Well, if he doesn't take subsidized, if he doesn't fit the government's model for what the government's going to subsidize, then he might get squeezed out that way, I suppose.
I actually spend a lot of time in clinics like that, reporting on them. I've been in clinics all over the country. And there's one I'm thinking of right now. I was in this summer when I was covering, I was at the Republican Convention. It was in Cleveland. I spent some time in a clinic there. I don't know the clinic you're referring to, but sounds like a little bit. Like it's a little bigger, but it's a community clinic where they serve the uninsured. And if you ask them, as I did, you know, I said, so what's the Affordable Care Act been like for you? They're like, it's been great. Because there's this overwhelming demand for those services. Now, what happens is when people get Medicaid coverage is they come in. Now, the clinic gets more money when it gets Medicaid. In fact, Medicaid pays federally what are called federally qualified health clinics, which are clinics that sort of, you know, they sort of certify that they can do a certain amount of services and stuff. They get a bonus out of this. This is one of the things in the Affordable Care Act no one ever hears about, but it's actually part of the law, is to kind of get extra money to these clinics. There's actually, in addition to that, there's actually a whole separate fund just to throw money at these clinics, partly because they know there's still a lot of people out there who are uninsured, and are still going to need coverage. But what this clinic gets to do now is because they got more paying patients, they can increase capacity. And the big thing was they talked about how many new services they could provide. You know, they're like, look, you know, we've been able to add mental health professionals, dietitians. We have so many people with diabetes. Now we're able to take care of these people. We're able to have social workers help them get back to work. And you know, one other thing is in these clinics, if you've been around them, you know, they're wonderful. They do amazing work with nothing, but it's hard because, like, you know, their prescriptions, they're relied on free samples. And, you know, if you have patients who are getting psychiatric meds, you know, you don't want to be switching brands. That is not good care. Well, now they can actually pay for it. And if they can pay for it, they can get the same psychiatric drug month after month. So the ACA has been a huge boon for these clinics. And in fact, if you were in Washington last week, the directors of a ton of these clinics were on Capitol Hill going door to door saying, please don't take away this lifeline. We need it.
30 more seconds. Guess the question.
Okay, so my stepmom is a developmental pediatrician out of Riley Children's Hospital in Indianapolis, and she has people of religious and ethnic minorities who travel 5 hours to see her, right? So your original point about how these other countries have increased access of care, there's a much reduced geographical distance that all these people have to go to for a single market. So how do you, in a country like the United States of America, where you have states that are, one, limited insurance markets in the state, hopefully that'll change, but also a larger distance between them. How do you increase access to care in these states that have very different geographical ranges of where people are going to get their provided care?
All right, that's a good question. If either party wants to answer the question in your summary statement, then do so. But we have to go to the summary in order to obey our time clock. Michael Cannon, you have 5 minutes to summarize. Then, Jonathan, you'll have your 5 minutes. Michael, take it away.
So, for any of you who are familiar with automotive history, there's a car that was developed in Germany from the 50s to the 80s, or maybe even into the 90s. It was called the Trabant. It was designed by the East German government. They had a monopoly over automotive production in that country, and it had a lot of interesting features. And one of the features of the Trabant was it was a two-stroke engine. So when you fill it up with gas, you would not only put the gas in the engine, you also put the oil in at the same time. You know, they had to mix together, and they really had to mix together. You had to mix them together. And the way you would mix them together is you'd put them both in the engine in the tank, and then you'd go to the side of the car, and you'd shake the car back and forth like this to mix them together. Now, I tell that story, and people laugh. And the reason people laugh is because we know better. I mean, we know that there are better cars. We know that you don't have to do. You can build cars in ways you don't have to do that. But whenever I think about healthcare and healthcare in the United States, not just healthcare in the United States, but across the world, I think about the Trabant, because if you lived in a world where there were only Trabants, you would just think, oh well, this is what you do with the cars. This is how cars work. And here we are in the United States, where we see healthcare prices and health insurance premiums constantly going up. We see all sorts of gaps in our healthcare sector where people are losing coverage when they change jobs and ending up with a pre-existing condition. We see all these horrible estimates of the numbers of medical errors, and on down the line, the outrageous prices that we see on the hospital bills and so forth, And I always think of the Trabant when looking at the U.S. healthcare sector, because in our healthcare sector, we are all shaking the Trabant. We are all putting up with just ridiculous stuff that we wouldn't have to deal with if we just allowed a market system to work, provide us better products, even if you still had public transportation. You know, the public transportation that would be available for the poor would be better if you allowed markets to make your automobiles. And if we did the same in healthcare, there are already all sorts of innovations that are just waiting to happen, waiting there, trying to break through these restraints that government has placed on them and make healthcare better and more affordable and more secure, particularly for the most vulnerable. Things like retail clinics staffed by nurse practitioners that make basic healthcare more affordable for the poor. Things like, as I mentioned before, dental therapists and dental hygienists practicing independently, doing the same thing with dental care. Integrated health systems that improve the quality of care while expanding access to care. and insurance innovations that drive down the cost of the insurance protections that we all need, and the financial, not just the financial protections, but also the access to care that we all need. What's standing in the way of these things is a litany of ways that government has inserted itself into our healthcare sector. We're all suffering as a result. We're all shaking the trabant as a result. And I'll just add, throw in that I haven't heard anyone bring it up in this room, but usually the response is, well, that just shows why we need single payer. And whenever I hear that, I think about another car made by another communist government called the Yugo. And they both made Time's top 50 list of worst cars ever made. They said that the Yugo came with a rear windshield defroster so it would keep your hands warm while you were pushing it. And I always think whenever anyone says that we need single payer, well, so you don't want to be shaking the trabant, you'd rather be pushing the Yugo. I'd rather do neither of these things. I'd rather bring better products within the reach of more people. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah. 5 minutes, Jonathan Cohn, for the negative. Please summarize.
I'm trying to imagine pushing the car with the Yugo. It's a good mental image. Michael has mentioned a lot of different examples of two kinds. He's given us examples where the government has done something poorly. It doesn't let nurse practitioners use all of their skills. We have a tax break for employer insurance that has made people get more health insurance than they otherwise want, and that's driven up prices. And he's mentioned examples of the private sector on its own innovating. Clinic, that gentleman who mentioned the clinic is an example of an innovation. I call that an innovation, somebody going out and providing for the indigent. Interesting insurance project, insurance that promotes good care rather than expensive care. And you know, that all, there's very little objectionable in most of that. There's absolutely no reason that anybody would oppose that, wherever on the market government spectrum they lie. You know, the question though is, what do we know about these different systems and how do they perform? And I want you to remember, here are, I would argue, undisputable facts. Number one, an insurance system left to its own devices will exclude people with known high risk. That is how insurance works. If you don't regulate insurance markets, then people who have to buy insurance on their own will be excluded if they are high risk. And number two, the cost of medical care has gotten to the point where very few people can pay for it on its own. And even if you believe that markets can dramatically reduce prices, and I am skeptical, but for the sake of argument, imagine they could reduce them substantially. It would still be too expensive for a large number of people to pay for. And so if you accept that kind of world, where we have free market insurance, no tax break, nothing, no one's in employer plans, everyone's buying on their own, you're accepting a world where a large fraction of the population is excluded. So what do we know about the alternatives? We know about two, again, I want to remind you of my two case studies because they're simple and we have data on them. We know how the European systems perform relative to ours. And we know that the Europeans are getting better access, fewer cost problems, and good outcomes. And the data is not really ambiguous on this. I mean, that is what they are getting compared to us. Now, Michael, I know, believes that our system is as socialized as theirs. I will disagree with him on that. I think that's wrong. I think you can make the case that, yes, these other systems are more along the government line, given the amount of control government has over prices, the amount, the percentage of their spending they do through the government. I think those are more government systems, and I think they have better results. And then we look at government insurance expansions here in the United States and what they've produced. Now, I am not here to tell you they are perfect by any stretch of the imagination. And again, if we were here to talk about the ACA, I could probably equal Michael in talking about what's wrong with that law, what hasn't gone well, where it's really struggling. I could tell you what's wrong with Medicaid and the problems that people on Medicaid have. But at the end of the day, what is the bottom line? Do those flaws outweigh the strengths, or do the strengths outweigh the flaws? Because we know that despite all those problems,
despite the very real flaws, that when government has expanded insurance, people are getting better access to care. They are more financially secure. And the evidence is a little ambiguous on this, but it's at least a close call, and I would argue persuasive that people are also ending up healthier. And this is not me talking. These are, you know, this is respected, peer-reviewed studies in the best medical journals, the best economic literature. And so when I look at that, and when you say that, and you think to yourself, is a market system really better, or do we need some kind of government role? Well, just look at that data. Look at the European systems versus the American system. Look at the American system after coverage expansions, before. And, you know, if you want to look at that and you think, well, gosh, you know, the market system actually is better. America is better than the European systems. Pre-government expansions is better than post. Well, then, you know, that's your answer. I think you look at the data. I think you look at the numbers. You see how many more people are getting access to care over there versus here and over here after the expansions versus before the expansions, the outcomes, what we know about them. And I think the case is pretty strong that government has an important role to play, and yes, a positive role.
Thank you, Jonathan. That concludes the debate. Now, please vote again on the resolution. A market system for medical care would save more people from suffering inadequate care than any other system. Vote for the resolution, vote against, or vote undecided. Please vote on the resolution, and then please stick around. You'll get ample opportunity to discuss the issues with our debaters. Michael Cannon is going to be catching a train back to Washington, D.C. a little after 10, but he promises to stick around until 9 o'clock so that we can all talk to him. Jonathan is staying in town. We can talk to him. If you didn't get a chance to ask your question... These guys are not, they're still in our employ until 9 o'clock, so bear that in mind. So it looks like we're going to close the voting. Naomi is going to give me the results. Okay. The yes vote was 57% initially, and the yes vote lost a point and went down to 55.7%. It actually lost 2 points. Yes vote went from 57.8 to 55.7. So the yes vote went down by 2 percentage points. The no vote, the yes vote was 57% and 55%, so it still got a majority, but it did go down by 2 percentage points. The no vote is still in minority, but it went up from 17% to 35%. Based upon the switch of the vote, we will have to hand the victory to Jonathan Cohn. Jonathan gets the Tootsie Roll. Congratulations.